Freeze Notice Weather Service was founded by two Iowa State grads in 1973. It became a service with a global reach, but the story of one of the founders starts long ago and far away. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. In 1945, the communist government of Albania closed the border. One-year-old Charlie Notice and his mother were on one side, and his dad and sister were on the other. For 10 years, the family was separated until he and his mother made a daring escape. I'll talk with Charlie Notice about his early life as told in his new memoir, From Hell to Iowa. We'll also talk weather later in the hour. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Meteorologist Charlie Notice and his partner Harvey Freeze started a business in 1973 that became one of the most relied on weather services in the world. But Charlie Notice's story starts long before Freeze Notice Weather was even an idea. He's written about his early life in the new memoir, From Hell to Iowa, Escape from Communist Albania, and he is here with me today. Hello, Charlie.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And I think we need to start with some history. The part of Albania that you were born into was contested territory, right? You're of Greek origin.
Correct. Full-fledged Greek.
All right. And so this area in Albania had been taken over by Albania. So you were in a Greek environment growing up, right?
Yeah. Actually, what happened was towards the end of World War I, I believe, that portion of southern Albania that used to be Greek territory, the border was redrawn, and they made that a part of Albania. And, there were a lot of Greeks in that portion of Albania, and it just so happened that my parents and myself, when I was born, we had some incredible circumstances.
And some incredible things happened before you were born as well. Your dad nearly lost his life. Can you tell me what happened?
Yes. He jokingly told the communist partisans that, if you guys don't watch out, one of these Greek a Greek would come in, I forgot his name now, but it doesn't matter, take care of you. But
And that turned out to be almost a fatal joke.
As soon
that he
as
made.
He said that, that was, it looked like that was going to be the end of my father. He was just joking. And he was put under house arrest. They were ready to execute him. And at the last minute, a friend of my dad's, my dad was about 25 years old at that time. This other Greek, his name was Minas Paras. He intervened and said, "Look, we're fighting for a common cause to try to get the Italians out of here. So you have my friend Nico. You're ready to execute him. How can you possibly do this? His mother is just cannot stop crying." And they agreed, and my father's life was spared. That was in 1941.
All right. That was in 1941. Not long after that, your father and mother were married. And did your father get taken prisoner and sent to a German concentration camp before you were born?
It was maybe right around the time I was born. My father and both my father and my uncle were taken prisoners by the Germans. That was probably around 1944, maybe the beginning of 44. They were placed in a concentration camp, but they weren't treated quite as badly as the Jews. They were obviously, when the war ended, they were released and they were dropped off in a northwest city in Greece. The name of the city is, in Greek, we say Ioannina, Ioannina. And my grandmother, my sister, and my mother and I, you know, I was just a little baby at the time. This was in the spring of 45. They were there to greet my uncle and my father. And my dad said, you know, I need to wait for a check to arrive from California from one of his uncles here in this city. So take the baby, go home, and I will meet you in a few days.
All right. So your sister stayed there with your father and your grandparents. Mm-hmm. Your mom needed to go home because your other grandmother was ill, right?
Correct. My dad's mother was ill. And
so she, being the good daughter-in-law, went home to take care of her mother-in-law, taking her baby with her. And then what happened?
Well, just as my mother and I crossed the border between Albania and Greece closed. That was the end. My dad tried to get in several times, but to no avail. And we were separated. That was it.
How long did,
for 10 years.
Right. How long did your dad stay in Greece trying to get home?
Probably, you know, maybe 6 months. But eventually they all ended up, my grandfather, my mother's father, was in Portland, Maine. And they all ended up in Portland, Maine, probably around 1946. And, you know, my dad had been trying for years to get us out. But, you know, it took quite a long time.
Well, let's talk about what life was like in this part of Albania in 1946. So the communists are in control in Albania. The borders are closed. Information isn't moving very readily throughout the country. What was life like for you? There was no electricity?
Well, there was nothing.
Nothing. So no electricity, no running water, indoor toilets.
I would say it was probably more backward than a third world country is today. I mean, we had nothing. Yeah, no running water, no toilets, indoor toilets, no toilet paper. You know, it was a very, very crude type of life. But we didn't know any better. At least I didn't know any better. So
did your was your father able to send letters home? Did your mother know what kind of life your father and your sister were leading?
Well, we could not imagine what kind of life that they were leading in the United States. My father eventually ended up in California, by the way. He went to work at a paper mill factory. He had relatives over there. My sister stayed with my grandmother in Portland, Maine, but they soon moved to Brockton, Massachusetts. But, you know, in Albania, it was just, you know, a very simple life. My dad would send letters and money once in a while, but you couldn't use this money in our town, in our village, which is called, by the way, Poličani.
And you couldn't use the money because there were no stores?
Are you kidding? No way. Once in a while, my mother would, with some friends, would take an all-day walk to reach the nearest big city. It is called Ajirokastro. And she could buy a few things in this city. And in fact, on one occasion, she took me with her. I was probably about 6 or 7 years old, I would say. And I have some vague memories of that. All I could, you know, when we got to this city, all you would hear is praises for the ruthless dictator, Enver Hoxha. And there were tanks marching up and down the streets and loudspeakers proclaiming how great this dictator was.
And those tanks were the first motorized vehicles you ever saw, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
In your village, you did have a school. What was your education like?
Well, you know, as I said, we were full-fledged Greeks, and this was Greek territory at one time. So we were taught in Greek at this school. But, you know, the last year or two of my stay in Albania, they were trying to convert. They were gradually converting to more and more Albanian. The very first thing that we would do each morning when we got to school, you know, we would stomp our feet down on the floor real hard, saying, "Down with the Americans." You know.
I'm surprised that maybe it was such a small village. Maybe it didn't matter. I'm surprised that the Albanians allowed that kind of Greek culture to continue.
Well, they did, like I say, for a while. Most of the people living in that area were Greek. But, you know, they gradually were converting to more and more Albanian.
So you were starting to learn the Albanian language?
Starting a little bit. I knew, you know, I definitely could understand some Albanian, but I'll tell you what, after the escape and what I saw, what Greece was like, and especially when I got to this country, I tried very hard to forget everything that was Albanian.
Right. The kind of communist education you were getting at school, you describe as brainwashing, and you feel like it was effective brainwashing.
Absolutely. I would say that had it been another 6 months to a year, I probably would not have agreed to go along with my mother and a couple other families.
And we'll talk about the escape mm-hmm. after a break, but you can base that possibility on the fact that there was another young girl about your age who refused to leave with her mother, right?
Exactly. She was just a little bit older than me, and she got to the point where she was definitely brainwashed, and she refused to go along.
Do you remember her mother talking about that on your journey?
I vaguely remember the situation, but all I know is that she just refused to go along, and I think the mother was hoping that someday, you know, she'd be able to see her
right.
daughter again.
So how old were you at this point?
I was almost 10 years old.
Okay, almost.
This was in early October of 1954.
And that's where we're going to leave it. We'll be back after a break to talk about that escape, that journey that you and your mother took when you left Albania, and then life in the United States after that. I'm talking today to Charles Notice. You may know his name because of his work with Freeze Notice Weather Service for many, many years, founded in 1973 in Iowa. He has written a memoir about his life experiences. It's called From Hell to Iowa, Escape from Communist Albania. Coming up later in the hour, we'll be joined by state climatologist Harry Hilliker, and we will do one of the things that Charlie does best, which is talk weather. That's coming up later in the hour, and you're welcome to join the conversation as well. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with Charles Notice. His name is a familiar one to many Iowans and many people around the world because of his work with Freeze Notice Weather Service. But we're talking today about his early life. He's written a memoir called From Hell to Iowa, Escape from Communist Albania. And just before the break, Charles, we were to the point where you were nearly 10 years old. You had been separated from your father and your sister and your maternal grandparents for nearly 10 years. Your mother, you and your mother were living in this tiny village in Albania. The grandmother that she had returned there to take care of when the borders closed had passed away. So it was just the two of you, right? Are you there?
Yes.
Okay. So it was just the two of you at
yes,
that point.
Yes, the two of us.
And one day she said to you, before you went to school, that night you were going to leave. Do you remember what she told you?
I certainly do. She said, in Greek, of course, everything is in Greek. Charlie, we are going to leave tonight. And you need to keep your mouth shut all day long. And don't say anything about it. I guess my mother really trusted me.
Yeah, I'm surprised that she told you at all.
She did. And, you know, thinking about it, I am also surprised that she told me at that morning. So that whole day, I was pretty nervous, but try to act, normal with my friends. And what
were you thinking that whole day?
I was almost 10 years old, and I was thinking, I will see some places that I've never seen before, and who knows what's going to happen. There was some fear because I pretty much knew that if we had been caught, that would be the end. Machine guns.
Right.
Kaboom. Done.
Well, and did you also feel fear? We were talking before the break about the communist education, what you were calling brainwashing, the fact that there was an older girl who refused to go on this trip because of the things that she had been taught about the outside world. Were you a little afraid of the idea of going to America? Were there things that you had been taught that you were thinking about?
Well, I was just full of apprehension. I was excited and apprehensive at the same time. I didn't know what to expect.
What had you been taught about America?
That it was the most evil country in the world. There was nobody as evil as America. That, like I said, every day in school, the very first thing in the morning, we would just stomp our feet and say, "Down with the Americans," all in Greek.
So your mother told you that you would be leaving after dark that night. Can you explain how this journey was arranged?
Sure. Okay. My dad, as I indicated earlier, had been trying to find a way to get us out. Finally, in 1954, he was in contact with one of his friends in Brockton, Massachusetts. And this friend also escaped with the help of a guide that knew every nook and cranny of that terrain, mountainous terrain. And it just so happened that this guide was now in the United States, and he got a hold of him, and it was agreed that each family that would go along with the escape would pay this gentleman a fee, okay? And it was like $1,500 at the time. My father was concerned at first, but, think about it. If we had been caught, that would have been the end. But he said, okay, finally, let's do it. And this guide, along with another gentleman who was the brother-in-law of one of the ladies that escaped with us, they crossed the border. They hid in this lady's house, and the word got to my mother, and we were supposed to meet at a designated spot well after dark. I remember it was a kind of a large rock that we met at. And the only thing that we could bring with us basically was a little bit of water, maybe a little bread. I was very saddened to leave, believe it or not, my goat behind and my cat. But, I did, and we did, and we met at this rock.
And how many were there in your group?
There were, I'd say about, I don't remember exactly, but there were about 8 or 9 people, just a fairly small group.
It's well after dark. And you walked all night?
We definitely walked all night. In fact, that's the only time we could walk, again, through this mountainous terrain. And
Did you have any light with you on the trail?
No light at all. It took us 3 nights. During the daytime, we would hide in the wilderness, in the mountains, forested area. And by the way, it's a good thing that it was early October because, a few weeks later, we wouldn't have been able to do it because, you know, we're crossing mountains and it does snow in those mountains.
Right. Although the nights were a little longer in October than they would have been earlier. So that would have been problematic, too.
That's correct. We did have one close call. After the first night, there was an Albanian soldier who was walking, smoking a cigarette down below. And he thought he heard something. He turned around, and actually it was a little girl that coughed just a bit. She had a little cold. And, you know, this soldier was looking up in our direction, but then he probably figured that it was just an animal sound. So he went along. He just proceeded along. Lucky break.
Wow. And you spent the day just waiting it out?
Just waiting it out, trying to rest during the daytime and, you know, trying to head to hide the best we could. We traveled for we walked for three nights. And finally...
And you ran out of water? Did you run out of food, too?
We hardly had any food to begin with. Just a little bread that, like I said, you know, maybe we brought with us. We ran out of water. We ran out of everything. Late on the third night, the guide said, okay, everybody, now extreme quiet. You know, we were very, very close to the border. By the way, the border between Albania and Greece, as far as air miles is concerned, it's only about 10 to 15 miles, no more. But, you know, you had to zigzag all around the place. So anyway, he said, everybody, absolute silence now. Probably about 4 o'clock in the morning, maybe 4:30, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, he said, we made it. We were free.
Wow.
We were safe. We crossed the border. And I remember the very first thing that we did was lick the dew from a tree, nearby tree, because we were so thirsty.
Off of the leaves.
Yeah.
Do you remember how you felt when he said you were safe?
I was, you know, everybody tells me that, and I kind of remember, I was kind of leading the group right in back of the guide. I was really, really, really excited. Just what the new world would bring to me in the coming months and years. Just very excited.
So, what was it like once the sun came up and you were in Greece? Where did you turn for help?
We walked to the very first town, the nearest town, which wasn't very far. The Greek army got a hold of us, processed us, and that was really the first time that I had they took us on a truck, and of course, to me, that was like, oh my God, what is this? I'm on a motorized vehicle. That is incredible.
Well, and you saw a lot of incredible things during that time in Greece.
Oh, yes.
And you did a lot of sightseeing, too, didn't you?
We did quite a bit of sightseeing. The most exciting was, of course, at the Acropolis. I was, you know, we were in Greece for almost a year, 6 months in this northwest city in Yanina, and then another 5 months or so in Athens.
And then that was waiting for your visa to come through?
Exactly, okay. For the naturalization papers to be processed. It took almost a year.
At that point, was it easier to communicate with your dad? Did you get more information from him?
Yes. Well, you know, it was much easier. But, of course,
you're still,
you know,
a world
telephones,
away. Right.
Telephones was, you know, we never spoke to him. That was kind of unheard of at the time, that, you know, communicate by telephone. This was in the spring and summer of 1955, for the most part.
Now, once that visa came through, you flew to the United States. So you went from never having seen anything but a tank that one time, then to riding on a truck and discovering Greece, and now you're getting on a plane to fly to America.
Getting on a plane. An unbelievable experience. And I had a very scary experience. I had no idea that, you know, where the plane was going to stop.
And it wasn't a very big plane.
It was a TWA, four propellers, which at the time was, you know, for that day and age, it was pretty large, I guess. But the plane started descending, and I thought we were going to crash. But actually what it was doing was it was landing in Rome. That was our first stop.
And you had several stops to make after that first stop when you thought you were going to die. Did someone explain to you what was happening?
Yeah, the stewardess did explain to me that, there will be a few more stops, so don't worry about it. The next one was Paris and then London and then Montreal, Canada, believe it or not, and then Logan Airport, Boston, Massachusetts.
And there was your dad, right?
And there was my dad and my uncle. Those are the two that picked us up.
Do you remember that meeting with your father, who, of course, you didn't have a memory of?
I didn't have a memory of, but, you know, he had left a couple of recordings on a disc, the old-time...
like a record.
Record, okay. Right, old-time record.
Mm-hmm.
And... we were able to play this once in a while in Albania with those winding type of record players.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew my father loved to sing. So he would, you know, he left a couple of songs on this record. So his voice was sort of familiar to me, but it was just an unforgettable experience to see my father and my uncle for the first time. And then shortly thereafter, of course, the rest of the family.
Right. And your sister, who
my
you
sister,
had
yeah.
again, no, and she's about 5 years older than you?
About 5 years older, correct.
Wow. So here you were in the United States. You didn't speak a word of English. You entered school in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
What was that experience like for you? You caught on very quickly, but I get the sense that you always felt kind of isolated.
Well, yeah, you know, my friends, I made friends quite rapidly, quite easily. In Brockton, Massachusetts, there were and there are a lot of Greeks, and the neighborhood that we lived in had a lot of Greeks. So I made friends, but I was really conscientious about the fact that, my God, I cannot speak like they can. I really need to learn exactly to speak exactly how they do. So that was always in my mind. And I picked it up. The first 6 months were kind of tough. But after that, it wasn't a big problem.
When did you fall in love with the weather?
Very early. Fortunately, the Boston market, the Boston, Massachusetts area, actually had TV meteorologists back in 1955, 56. And I started watching them. And first of all, I was fascinated by the weather in Massachusetts.
Very Absolutely. Different from Albania.
Quite different. Just really fascinated. And I loved to watch the TV meteorologists, especially, you know, their names are Don Kent and Bob Copeland at the time. Bob Copeland, by the way, is still alive. He lives a great life in northern New Hampshire right now. I said from pretty much early on, by the time I got to the seventh grade or so, junior high school, I said, I know exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going to become a meteorologist.
Did you want to be on television, or what was your goal?
I wasn't sure. TV was a possibility. But I just wanted to be a meteorologist and forecast the weather. And in fact, way, way before I got a degree in meteorology, I would give my friends a weather forecast based on a little map, a crude little weather map that I would see in the newspaper, and trying to project what was going to happen with that particular cold front or the warm front, and you know, in the next couple of days.
So you went to college. You knew you wanted to go to graduate school in meteorology. Mm-hmm. You had a very close call with the Vietnam War. You were drafted and nearly sent overseas, but
that was another miracle,
right,
that happened.
Right,
in
you
my
were
life.
You were granted leave because of family hardship.
Yes, my father was had a stroke. Let me put it this way: I was drafted. This was in the fall of 68. I was supposed to attend graduate school at Iowa State University after getting my bachelor's degree from Bridgewater State College in Massachusetts, which was only about 10 miles down the road from my house. But that was interrupted because I was drafted.
Well, we're going to leave that story there. We'll get back in just a moment. I'm talking with Charles Notice. He has written his memoir, From Hell to Iowa, Escape from Communist Albania. He went on, of course, to co-found the Freeze Notice Weather Service. Coming up in just a minute, we'll also be joined by state climatologist Harry Hilliker. We'll talk weather, and you can join us, 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, my guest is Charles Notice. He is one of the co-founders of Freeze Notice Weather Service, and he's written his memoir. It's called From Hell to Iowa, Escape from Communist Albania, focusing really on the first 10 years of his life and a daring escape that he and his mother made from communist Albania to freedom. And in just a moment, we'll be joined by state climatologist Harry Hilliker. We're going to talk weather. You're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Charlie, we interrupted the story of your being drafted during Vietnam. You were on the cusp of being sent overseas when you were granted a leave.
Yes, I was within 4 hours of being shipped out to Oakland and Vietnam. My father had a stroke a few months earlier, and they were trying to get me a compassionate reassignment in the States to support the family, but that was turned down. And then the last minute, I was within four hours, like I said, they held me over. I didn't know what was going on. But I was, you know, to make a long story short, I was given a hardship discharge just a few months later, and this was an incredible miracle that happened because within 2 weeks after being sent to Vietnam, the rest of my the company that I was with got killed.
Wow.
But I was spared, and I think about that to this day constantly. You know, why did this happen? Why was I spared? I mean, you know, you're talking about escaping from Albania, spared from Vietnam, just several incredible things that took place in my life.
You had to spend a little time on the East Coast because of that compassionate leave or the hardship leave.
Mm-hmm.
But you ended up making that journey to Iowa to go to graduate school at Iowa State University. And you studied meteorology here. Then when you were starting to look for a job, there were no jobs, right?
There were no jobs at the time. There were a tremendous number of cutbacks in the budget. This is during the Nixon administration. I met Harvey Freeze at Iowa State University. We decided, well, since nobody is hiring, maybe we can do something crazy and start something on our own. And, of course, since his last name is Freeze and my last name is Notice, spelled differently.
Right.
N-O-T-I-S.
Right. But it sounds like destiny.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it was definitely meant to be, you know, almost like another miracle.
And the two of you really made your way because you were able to produce more accurate forecasts than any of the other services that were available then?
Well, we had to be accurate because people were paying us for our service. And we had to provide detailed forecasts to meet the customer's needs. For example, a construction company, you know, they need to know a lot of detail about, you know, exactly how cold it's gonna get, if it's during the spring or fall when, you know, they have to cover, if it's going to be below freezing and so forth, or exactly when it's going to start raining. They had to plan. If it's going to rain all day, they would call their workers off, you know, forget it, you know. But we saved weather-sensitive type customers a lot of money because of these forecasts.
What do you think you were able to do in forecasting that made you more accurate than the other services that, that these organizations could have relied on?
Well, you know, to really be a good weather forecaster, you have to have a great passion for it. And as I indicated to you earlier, I started getting a passion when I was just a little kid in Massachusetts. You have to have a feel for it. It's very difficult to explain. It's not a simple matter of solving an atmospheric equation. It's not an exact science, like they say. So you have to have a good feel for what's going to happen. There are all kinds of models, forecast models that came out over the years. But, a lot of times, none of these models are any good. So you have to judge as to exactly what's going to happen.
I want to bring state climatologist Harry Hilliker into the conversation now. Hello, Harry.
Good morning, Charity and Charles.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And now, Harry, you have the benefit of hindsight with so much of what you do, because in so much of your work, you're looking back on what has happened. But I'm curious, we were just talking about the accuracy of forecasting. And of course, these days, there are a lot more computers involved in forecasting than individuals, although meteorologists still do great work. Harry, do you feel like we're becoming more accurate with our forecasting?
Yeah, without a doubt, and especially on the shorter term, next few days out to a week, and some cases out to a couple of weeks, and it's really just amazing the progress that's been made as far as precision and accuracy. And now it's not, well, it's a chance of rain this weekend. We could say, well, it's a chance of rain, but looks like the best chance is Saturday afternoon or wherever the case may be. Don't want to get anyone afraid. I don't think we actually have a chance this particular weekend, but there's a tremendous improvement in those forecast accuracy and precision over just the last, 10 or 20 years.
Well, and Charles, do you feel like there's less role for human input in that forecasting?
Well, I would say, maybe I'm old school, but one reason I retired when I did a few years ago is because in our line of work, private weather consulting, there were so many forecast models that came out that, the customers would say, well, what about this model? And what about that model? And, they're supposed to be pretty accurate out to 15 days, which is, not really true. But I definitely agree with Harry that, especially in the short range, the weather forecast accuracy has increased tremendously over the last 20, 30 years.
Now, of course, we do experience some pretty big surprises. Last winter was one of those big surprises, at least to a lot of us, with what we all like to call the polar vortex last winter. And I'm curious, Harry, we have these great names that we like to pin on weather phenomena now. Are these the same things that have been happening over these many cycles, or was last winter something kind of new?
Well, actually, all kind of the same thing. Just for whatever reason, I'm not really quite sure why that polar vortex term became so popular last winter.
Cause I guess it's good branding.
I think I know why. I think I know why.
Charles, why?
Sensationalism.
Okay.
that's one reason. Thing that I cannot stand these days. Just people try to, the media especially, try to sensationalize. We have a little thunderstorm, and oh my God, it's going to be the end of the world.
Well, and we use that kind of language a lot. Snowpocalypse, that kind of thing. We actually use the language that brands it as the end of the world when there's a storm coming,
The term polar vortex has been a meteorological term for decades.
So, Harry, when you look back at last winter, what did make that unusual?
Well, for us, at least in Iowa, obviously it means different things different places, but here in Iowa, I think the big thing was just how persistent that cold weather was. And really got started about middle of October, and not much break until we got well into April. We're just consistently on the colder side of normal. We might get a break or two for the last a day or two or three here and there that we got a little on the warmer side of normal, but just a very long, cold winter. Weren't setting many records, not many record lows set, anything like that. It's just consistently cold day after day, week after week, month after month, and type of winter we hadn't seen in Iowa in going back to 35 years, winter of 78, 79.
Now, a lot of people are predicting that we'll experience the same thing again this year. Maybe, I don't know which one of you wants to weigh in on that. Can we know that at this point?
Well, I guess I have my opinion.
Let's
and
hear
Harry
it.
Can chime in too.
Right.
I do not think we're going to see a repeat of last winter. The key is El Nino, I believe, right now. El Nino is definitely starting to form. We'll probably have a weak El Nino already, and the stronger it gets, the better off we are as far as if you hate cold. I think it's going to be more of like a normal type of winter, close to normal from Iowa eastward on a strip, and possibly even above normal temperatures across the far northern tier of states from the Dakotas up towards northern New England. So I think this month of November is going to be cold, for sure. But overall, for December through February, it's not going to be like it was last winter, with, as Harry said, absolutely persistent cold.
Harry, do you want to weigh in on that?
Well, yeah, it's one of the things that we're mentioning at the beginning of this segment about how much better short-term forecasts have gotten over the recent few decades. And I wish I could say the same thing for long-range outlook, but I think for
exactly.
the most part, there's been very, very little progress in that endeavor. And so a lot of people were surprised what last winter turned out to be like and wasn't really expected then. And you just never know. Charlie is mentioning about El Nino, and a great deal of the time that does mean a milder than normal midwinter season for Iowa. In fact, we had 8 consecutive El Ninos that did just that. El Nino events from mid-70s up through early 2000s. But the last one 5 years ago was a very long cold winter and snowy winter. So every once in a while you get an exception. So even having El Nino doesn't guarantee things will be nice, but it's really...
Nothing is guaranteed in weather.
Right.
Yeah, that's for sure. And so, as far as what to expect now, the Weather Service outlook is basically going... near normal, I guess you'd say, equal chances, whatever term you want to use, but for below, above or below normal temperatures. But that last month's outlook did have us on the warmer side, so kind of trending down on that, mostly because El Nino has been slower to really get on track. And so really hard to say. It's one of those things I wish I had a good answer for folks, but to have a repeat of last year would be hard to do. But,
yes,
exactly.
It could happen, but the odds would be pretty slim.
So, Harry, I've been reading through your reports over the last couple of months, and one of the very important things that you've pointed out over the last couple of months is the moisture quantity that we've had, both in rainfall but also ground moisture. Does it look like we are safely out of a drought period?
Yeah, certainly are. And actually, it's kind of happened a couple of times. We had the big drought 2012, which kind of got us beginnings in 2011. And then record wet spring last year, 2013,
right.
A very wet April and May, pretty much eliminated all drought vestiges at that time, but didn't last long. We ended up having a very dry summer late last 2013. And fortunately, not all the hot, but very dry through the late summer and through the fall months. And still had some issues coming into this year, but relatively decent rainfall this last spring. And then, of course, started getting too much rain once it got to mid-June, and a lot of flooding going on across the state through the second half of June and early part of July. And since then, some areas have still been very wet, especially southwestern Iowa. But for the most part, we've got plenty of moisture. River levels are all normal to above normal. Groundwater is normal to better than normal. And soil moisture levels really, plentiful, I guess, at this time of the year. And with winter coming on, vegetation not growing any longer, it's going to be plentiful starting next growing season off as well.
So it seems like we're in a very good situation for entering the winter as far as agriculture goes.
Yeah, one thing, I guess, in particular, last winter we had really deep frost penetration, which caused a lot of issues with plumbing and even water mains and such breaking because of the persistent cold. And we had a lot of very cold weather before we had any snow cover during especially November, the very beginning of December. And very dry soils really help, will cool off much more rapidly than wet soils will. So if we, by some chance, did have a repeat of last winter, we hopefully would not have that similar deep frost penetration we had a year ago, just because the extra soil moisture should slow that frost penetration down quite a bit.
Now, Charles, before we run out of time, you write about your retirement and what you've been doing with your retirement time. It sounds like you're still pretty passionate about weather, though.
Oh, yes. One of the things that you read in my book is that I'd like to trade commodities. And, you know, if you trade commodities, weather-related commodities like corn and beans and natural gas and things like that, you have to be on top of the weather, because that's probably the number one criteria for determining what the prices are going to be.
So who do you depend on for your forecasting?
Oh, gosh. Everybody has the information, right? These days is plentiful, free, all free. Years ago, we used to pay $2,000 or $3,000 a month just to get a couple little crude models at freeze notice. But now everything is free on the Internet, and you get, all kinds of models at you want to look
at the click of a mouse. Do you feel like we're more knowledgeable about meteorology than we used to be? Because all of us have access to all of this information.
I think so, but it's come to the point where every Tom, Dick, and Harry thinks that they can be a meteorologist by just by looking at the color-coded forecast model on the computer.
What do you think the future is for meteorologists?
I think it's exciting. We're definitely making advancements in the field, and I'm excited about it.
How about you, Harry? You must see a lot of young people coming up, and the world in meteorology is changing really rapidly.
Yeah, it certainly is, and it's kind of different now, because I used to, for years, was located in the National Weather Service office, worked for the state of Iowa Ag Department, but was located with the Weather Service, and you hear the forecasters talking and discussing things, and just the years I did that, there were just more and more things that they were looking at, more and more ideas to help improve, really small details of the forecast, but especially with snowfall, things that really made quite a difference in snowfall forecasting. So I'm not really around that on a day-to-day basis any longer, because I'm kind of isolated over the Capitol complex now, in a basement office, no less.
But, no one knows.
But, it's still a very exciting field. As I mentioned, there's not been a whole lot of progress in the long-range forecasting, but I think as time goes on, hopefully that net will get cracked as well and start to get there was certainly some skill there, but there's a lot of room for improvement on
Harry,
that time scale.
Thank you so much, State Climatologist Harry Hilliker.
Thanks for having me.
And Charles Notice, thank you.
Thank you, Charity.
Charles Notice has written about his life in the new book, From Hell to Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.